more guillotine, more disemboweled American dream. If you hate it so much, then why are you here? Because sometimes the building collapses, but the rubble keeps bleeding. Because sometimes the only thing you can carry with you is your blood. Because sometimes the water is more inviting than where you stand. That's how little kids end up washing up on shore. And I'm not just talking about the ones who make it. Do you know what it's like to escape genocide just to be gunned down in your own house? Don't they know that they're just finishing what our dictator started? Ever since they handed me the death certificate, no, the certificate of naturalization, I've been seeing ghosts. I've been seeing ghosts mostly in the mirror, at the dinner table, at the family picnic. We were naive enough to believe that we could hold home and here without anyone having to leave. I met the president, sat with him at a table, too small to hold everything that brought us there. His hands resting. Mr. President, where are your chains? I thought your hands were tied. You know, when they sent those kids back, when they wouldn't take the refugees, when they closed the borders but not Guantanamo. Mr. President, why do they call it the land of the free when even the dead can't leave? Mr. President, what does one caged bird say to another? I couldn't hear him. Over the sound of the corpse lying between us. He stared at me as if he thought I was afraid. Doesn't he know that back home, the women take care of the bodies?
So we are back. So that was a beautiful poem. Please look into Emmy Mahmoud if you've never heard of her. She is the most amazing poet. And I'll be featuring her a lot on this show because I feel like she embodies empowerment, she embodies intersectionality, she embodies what it is to be a woman in this day and age, being a woman of color, being a woman of minority. So let's get into the top five countries and why do these top five countries have so many refugees? Interestingly enough, which is actually not interesting, it is alarming. Two-thirds of all refugees come from these five countries. Number one is Syria, and there are 6.3 million refugees that are displaced currently from Syria, and that is due to the Syrian civil war that is happening. There are so many elements that play into this war. You have Bashar al-Assad's regime, and you have the rebel fighters. Then you also have ISIS, you have the involvement of Russia, you have Kurdistan's involvement, you have Turkey's involvement, you have America's involvement, or right now Trump is removing his soldiers. So there are so many elements that play into Syria. So these refugees have no hope at all. Next, the number two country is Afghanistan, with 2.6 million refugees. Unfortunately, Afghanistan is in what we call a gray war, and it is between Afghanistan and the United States. Of course, we know about its involvement in the so-called war on terror. Since around 2007, it's been around 17, 18 years. These people are still displaced, and there are still an alarming amount of refugees coming out of Afghanistan. Next, we have Sudan. And Sudan, in the past year, has went from 1.4 million to 2.4 million, which is extremely alarming. And there is no media representation as to what is happening in Sudan. And there is currently an uprising against the government. People are being killed. People are being killed. There's tear gas being thrown. It's horrific. So please look into Sudan if you haven't. A lot of people don't know what is going on there. Next, we have Burma, and we're actually going to talk about what's happening in Burma in a little bit. But there is 1.2 million refugees in Burma, and there is an ethnic genocide against the Muslim Rohingya population that is there. And then fifth, we have Somalia. And Somalia currently has around 900,000, closer to a million refugees. And within Somalia, so IDP, what we called an internally displaced person that has no rights internationally. There's 2 million of them within Somalia. And Somalia is kind of complicated because it's been about 25 years of armed conflict within it. And there's also other factors like drought and natural hazards. And then, of course, there are many more countries. We have Palestine, we have Iraq, we have the Democratic Republic of Congo, then we have the Ukraine, and we have Guatemala, and of course we have Yemen, and then we have Mexico. So the world that we live in, specifically after 2010, has just changed for the worse. There is so many, leaving behind natural calamities, there are so many civil wars that have been going on within these countries post-Arab Spring. So we need to take urgent action. We're going to take a little break now, but afterwards we'll talk about the urgency of refugees and why it is something that we have to take care of now. We can't wait. It's something that is affecting all of us, and it is our obligation as an international community to do more and to do better. So I will leave you with Nas I Can, and we will be back very shortly.
I know I can.
So we are back. We now are going to talk about the urgency of why we need to be involved in assisting refugees. Specifically, so we're going to talk about the urgency. Sorry, a little scatterbrained there. So let's go into statistics about what is happening. 28,300 people are forced to flee their homes every single day because of violence and persecution. To relate that on a personal level, there is, in our campus at Laurier, about 18,500 students. So if this entire campus had to pack up and leave, that wouldn't even equate to 2/3 of the amount of people who are doing that every single day. New displacement is very high. Displacement is people who don't have a refugee camp to go to, don't have a country to seek asylum to. They're just running around trying to survive. One person becomes displaced every 2 seconds. So I took that statistic from a website and it had at the bottom less than the time it takes you to read this sentence. So that's 30 people displaced every minute. One in every 110 people globally is either an asylum seeker, an internally displaced, or a refugee. So the situation isn't getting any better. It's getting much, much worse. And we need to take urgent action because these people need to find, they need to survive, basically. And we, as an international community, have that as our obligation. And we'll go into the Geneva Convention and why countries, around 145 of them, have a legal obligation to these people. And the countries who host the most refugees are Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, Germany, Canada, and Pakistan. And we can't rely on just those countries to host. And even those countries who host, they can still do better and they can still do more. And we'll get into resolution later on. So let's just talk about travel conditions that these refugees have to go through. Because there is a misconception that these people are coming to these countries because they'd like a better life. And ooh, they don't really like life in wherever they've come from, let's say Syria. And this person wants to go to, let's say, Canada. So they're willing to risk leaving behind their entire family, their entire heritage, everything they've ever known and loved, packing that up, traveling in the worst conditions, and just come to Canada for the sake of a better life, for the sake of comfort. That doesn't make sense to anyone. And the fact that Trump can say that about people it's enraging to me. So they have to cross borders, and borders involve crossing seas and going across waters, and that is extremely dangerous. A person who came into the media recently, or maybe a couple years ago, was Alan Kurdi. This story is awful. This child washed up on shore, his body, and that was only when the Western media decided to pay attention to the refugee crisis in Syria, and that was only when Trudeau went out to apologize about doing less. And then the next day he went and said, okay, we'll take in 100,000 refugees. And that's good on him for trying to fix what happened. But we don't need to see a photo of a dead child who could have had a life in order for us to amend things and to do better and be better. So basically the travel conditions that these people go through is around, they'll pay an enormous fee and someone will promise them, okay, I will get you through, for example, from Syria to the Macedonia border. So they'll pay whatever they have. They'll get into a boat that'll fit around 10 people. This boat is not meant for long destinations. And they will get on this boat and there'll be 50 to 60 people on a boat that can seat only 10. So just imagine this with me. They will travel on this boat that is meant for short distances for days. No access to public restrooms, no food, no water, except everything they can carry with them. And this is including women and children and men all jumbled together. Of course, the tides are never in their favor. So the chances of these people drowning is very, very high. And that's exactly what happened to Alan Kurdi and his entire family. So his father lost his wife and all his children. And someone, I think it was Piers Morgan, had the audacity to say that it was a selfish move from his side to go and travel to seek a more cushiony life in the States or wherever he was trying to go. And that's just not true. If you understand the condition that these people have to travel in just to get to one border to the other, you'd understand this is out of urgency and the need to survive. Not only that, but women are especially susceptible when traveling these borders, and they're susceptible to rape, sexual abuse, often prostitution, and we'll talk about that in when we go into talking about the impact on Syrian women and the refugee crisis. Of course, there's violence at the borders, so there's tear gas. The border police is extremely violent when dealing with people. There is gunshots and there's killing and it's just awful. So anyone who would dare suggest that these people leave their countries for the sake of having a better life, a cushiony better life, that's better to say, has no grasp on reality and is extremely ignorant as to what these people are actually going through. So let's just go into how the Syrian refugee crisis. I want to talk about women specifically because we have to understand intersectionality and things don't affect people the same way with your identity, your religion, your social class, your race. All these things influence the way that you perceive life and how you're impacted. So Syrian women experience a gender role reversal when they are refugee women. So they come from primarily traditional households. Their societies is a traditional patriarchal society where men dominate most aspects of civil society. So in the family, men are the breadwinners and they are the protectors of the family. There's a very low female participation rate in the workforce. So it's about 12.23%. And Syrian women are still unfortunately met with gender stereotypes, are expected to take on the role of the caretaker of the family, and that is, of course, cooking and cleaning and raising the children. So that's what it is like for them back home. And we have to understand where these people are coming from in order to resolve what they are going to go through in the next stage of their lives and to understand what exactly is going on with them. So let's talk about what happens to these women during the journey. They're preyed on by police and local security guards to perform sexual tasks in return of basic aid. So that could be medicine, that could be a place to sleep, that could be to be able to cross the border. robbery, extortion, and sexual assault is a very, very common occurrence to these Syrian women. And there is a term that is now invented because of it, and it's survival sex, where these women have to resort to prostitution in order to survive. And of course, because women are more susceptible to that than men. And a concept that is unfortunately has risen in the awakening of the Syrian refugee crisis is child brides. So this is very common. Women, children, I must say, girls that are as young as 10 to 13 years old marry men 10, 20, 30, 40 years older than them in order to ensure protection and for their mothers to be sure that these girls are going to be financially stable and physically stable so that no one can harm them. Because again, in their societies, men are the protectors and men are the breadwinners. So before women cry out feminism and this is unethical, where are you to protect these Syrian women? You are in your houses, in your privileged, I don't know where, that could be anywhere in the West, it could be anywhere in Europe, and these women have to do the worst possible things just to survive. So we need to understand the context and where they're coming from, and we need to understand that we have been absent as an international community, and we can't blame these people for doing the bare minimum to survive, no matter how horrific it is. Then we'll go into role reversal. So now these Syrian women are the providers, they are the protectors, and they are the breadwinners of their family. So responsibilities they now have, from before it was just taking care of the family, cooking and cleaning and being that housewife. Now it's having to travel in the worst possible conditions. They now have to be responsible to provide food in places where you don't know if you're going to wake up the next morning alive. They have to find a household. They have to ensure education for their children. They have to get health care. They have to integrate into an entirely new society where there's language and cultural barriers. It's so much for these women to handle. And of course, they end up feeling displacement and fear, and as a reaction to this, the men within that society respond with gendered violence and a sense of superiority. So their masculinity has been targeted because they can no longer provide in the ways that they were able to before, so it results into violence. And in a later episode, we'll talk about masculinity and how hegemonic masculinity leads to violence between men and women, and it is also so much for the men to handle. So the patriarchy is both, it affects both men and women in negative ways. And of course, these women, we can't forget, are victims of war. A lot of people, when dealing with refugees, they don't think about what they had to go through before. They just think about them now. They've been in areas of conflict and violence. These people have lived under bombings and seen members of their family dismembered or killed in front of them. So they face a lot of mental and emotional hardships, and they don't have access to healthcare. If these people don't have access to healthcare, if someone's leg has been amputated or someone has been shot in the face, how are they able to get access to mental health care, which is something that they really need, because these women usually have PTSD, they usually have depression and anxiety, and it's just so much just for her to handle. And we are going to have a break. We will be back. I will leave you guys with a song. Today we are going to be listening to Ice Cube, and that is Good Cop, Bad Cop. So we will be back very soon. Break them off, son. So in the wake of talking about depression and depression dealing with refugees, we're going to listen to a small slam poem by a Sudanese poet named Mona Abdullahi. And she, in the poem, is called Explaining Depression to a Refugee. And I think this will give a lot of perspectives on privilege and mental illness, because there is privilege associated with mental illness and access to healthcare and being able to diagnose yourself as depressed in the first place. So let's just hear what that is before we go into our next topic. I promise that I know you very well. Your eyes never lie, even if they tell.
oppression is a white man's privilege. We do not have the privilege to have that much time to ourselves. Three, she says, look, in order for someone to be depressed, one first must be living. All we have been doing is surviving. Four, she says, how do you tell a person they have mental illness when there is nothing mental about surviving? Just running and running and running and running and trying to not have your child witness the sound of a bullet going through flesh before they witness the holy sound a vowel can make before it turns into a word that eventually becomes a language. And running and running and running, sir, we would like a new doctor for my daughter. My daughter is not depressed. Five. She says, how can one be depressed if your native tongue doesn't even speak of it to its existence? Our people do not get depressed. Six, she does not get depressed. So, sir, we would like another doctor for my daughter. Seven, the doctor looks at me and asks me, what do you think? Eight, what do I think? I wonder if he realizes he just told a woman who sacrificed everything to the bone to protect her children from war of a fight she cannot protect me from, a fight she cannot help me flee from, run from, sacrifice from. I wonder if he realizes what that will do to her. Ten. I wonder if this is the moment she realizes wars doesn't end when the gun stops shooting. Maybe that's why denial is the loudest thing in this room right now. 11. I wonder why the depression test asked me to rank how often I cry and not why I don't cry at all. 12. I wonder if he realizes the hopes, dreams, and expectations of my generation is the main thing keeping my mother's generation standing. 13. Why is my mother sitting? 14. I wonder if today is the day my mother realizes, although she could stop running when she got to the U.S., my generation, the Somali diaspora, is still running, stuck in between two cultures, trying to uplift both expectations. 15, we are still running. I am still running, just not from guns. 16, I wonder if today is the day my mother ties the Somali diaspora to a white man's privilege. 17. I wonder if today is the day my mother realizes that the Somali diaspora is gaining a fight she cannot protect us from, a fight she cannot help us flee from, run from, sacrifice from. 18. I look at my mother, and I look at the doctor. 19. What do I think? 20. We would like to have a new doctor and bandages for my splinters from running.
So we are back, and we are back with Adele, who is a global studies student with me in global studies. We're going to first talk about the Rohingya crisis, the genocide that is happening in Burma. There's a lot of confusion, first of all, between Myanmar and Burma. And Burma is kind of saying Burma and calling it Burma is kind of empowering for Rohingyas because that is what they call the country. And Myanmar is what the Buddhist population now refers to it as. So calling it Burma is a way of reinforcing your support with the Rohingya population. So we're going to ask her a little bit of questions as someone living in Canada, someone who is taking global studies, which is kind of a program that allows you access to more information as to what is happening worldwide than the typical student. And we'll see what she thinks about representation in the media, what Canada does
to highlight these issues and if she believes that there is a hope for a resolution for these people. So first of all, the other day in our department, they hosted an event where someone by the name of Yusuf Zain made a documentary with refugees from Rohingya. And it was a way to, at the beginning it didn't start as a documentary, it was a manner in which they were to resolve all their past trauma from coming from Burma and seeing their members of their family killed, seeing their friends slaughtered in front of them. And they did that through art and theater. And as someone who has done theater, I think that was so beautiful. We always go to the more traditional ways of healing, and people underestimate the power of theater and what that really can do for a person. So basically what is happening right now is Rohingyans are the indigenous people to Burma. They have been there thousand and thousand and thousand of years before, and they are a Muslim population. What the Myanmar or the Burmese government says about these people is that they never existed. They don't exist. There are no Rohingyan people there. They are people who have come from Bangladesh and claim Rohingyan identity. And why that would be confusing is that Bangladesh is right near the border of Burma. And why that is alarming is that this is a ethnic genocide. They walk around with big banners. If you just Google it, it's very accessible to see, saying no Rohingyan people, exterminate Rohingyan people, we don't want them here. And they target them specifically and they kill them and they torture them. And there has been so many reports, but the government denies everything that is happening. And since they are Buddhists, which is a very peaceful religion, and as we know, people can take religion and use it to their own perverse agendas, people don't believe that these people are actually committing these horrific crimes that they are. And they target these Muslim people and they kill them. And now these people, as we said, they're the third most displaced people, with 1.2 million refugees and counting. And there is no coverage for these people in the media. I didn't even know the extent of what was happening. I think I knew an eighth of what was happening, and I had thought that I was aware of the situation before seeing this documentary. So even if you go onto Wikipedia, Wikipedia won't even acknowledge the existence of these Rohingyan people, and they're indigenous to it. If we look back at old there's historian artifacts that prove the existence of these people, but it just goes to show how far genocide is and how it can infiltrate the media and it can control, and especially if you're in a position of power. So let's just talk to Adele about her perspective as to the coverage. So first of all, hi Adele.
Hey, what's up?
So Adele is with me in class. Adele, she hasn't seen the documentary. So Adele, what do you think with the coverage of the Rohingyan people?
I honestly think, like, if you haven't gone to that documentary, you wouldn't know exactly what's going on. I myself, like, until we were introduced to it in our lectures to attend this film documentary, I had very little knowledge about it. And now I have a little bit more of understanding from what you told me. But I don't think it's being properly addressed, and we're not being taught. We get aware of it, but we're not getting into the details, and the details is where it's more important, because there are so many things that is happening that are going unnoticed, and it's such a huge problem.
So you are a global studies student, so you have more access to knowing about these issues.
Right.
What would you say about the average Canadian, or specifically the average Laurier student? Do you think that they would know about these things that are happening?
I would say they don't. Because, like you said, we are studying this. This is our major. This is something that we delve into. And any other majors, they're unaware. Like, they have, obviously, the basic knowledge of what the news is providing for that. But the news itself is not covering everything. You're just hearing, you know, the bigger issues with Trump and things like that. And if I spoke to any of my friends that are in different majors, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't know what I'm talking about. I would have to explain, and it's just a whole mess in general.
Do you think that there is hope for resolution from what you know as a global studies student?
I would love to say that there's hope. Like, I think it's anyone's dream to achieve peace amongst these countries, but things have not gotten better. And it may seem to someone who isn't studying that, you know what, there have been improvements, but if you really delve deeper, there's so many things that are still going on and not being noticed. And I think that's a big problem, and that's why I see hope is very slim. Mm-hmm. Until we address, until everyone has knowledge and say, this is what's happening and this is an issue and we need to address it, I think hope will see that light more clearer.
Just on the topic of awareness, so Sudan right now there's a revolution going on, people are dying, people are being massacred.
Mm-hmm.
As a global studies student, did you know about what was happening in Sudan?
I actually haven't gotten that much knowledge based on it. Like, I wish I can tell you, like, everything that's happening, but that is information I would have to research and find myself. I think there should be a little bit more focus on that. We have breezed past that topic, like, we've dipped our toes
in
it.
Yeah, like, in class, we'll be like, oh, countries that are having persecution, we'll just mention Sudan.
Exactly, or you read it briefly in a chart in one of our textbooks, but you don't know exactly what's going on. All you hear is just terms. You hear genocide, you hear invasion, like, war, conflict, and that's it. You don't really hear what is actually happening and who is suffering and what is being done to end these sufferings.
Do you think that there is a disconnect from reading so much about these things that we've become sensitized? Do you think it's too much at the same time?
I think so too, because, you know, they pile on different conflicts, different levels of war and stuff like that. And they try to bring everything together. They try to,
It groups it all into one.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, you can't focus properly on a concern or, like, a conflict properly if you're just trying to combine everything together and teach you this is what's happening and, you know, try to find a solution. It's not working like that.
And it's also a question of which one do I even focus on?
Exactly.
Because all of these demand such urgency.
Right.
And you're going to be biased at the end of the day as to what you focus on. So I think I have a bias more to the Middle East because I'm from there.
Exactly.
And I don't really know what's happening in the Republic of Congo, for example, or in Guatemala. I don't know what's going
on. Yeah, anything like that it's understandable. You're from the Middle East yourself, so you have obviously the more knowledge, but you don't know what's going on, you know, in Africa, like the African continent and mm-hmm. everything else. Like, it's a huge universal problem. Mm-hmm. I think it's not only you, it's myself too. Like, as someone from South America,
mm-hmm.
I can tell you a little bit more about Central America and their issues than
because
maybe
you're from Guyana,
right. And so it's everybody, it's not just you. And I think we need to expand our knowledge, like, look beyond
mm-hmm.
our own, like, go beyond the borders.
Mm-hmm.
So
thank you so much, Adele.
Thank you for having me.
I will see you in class in like 5 minutes.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just going to talk very briefly about my experience as a Palestinian refugee. And I just like to thank Adele again because she's skipping class with me to be here. So I really appreciate her. I'll just talk about quickly about my experience as a refugee from Palestine. So in 1948 is a time called Al-Nakba. What happened was it was the advancement of illegal settlements from Israel into territories that was not promised to them by the UN, because the UN, there was a resolvement and they said this area is Palestine and this area is Israel, but Israel continues to place illegal settlements into those locations. So the place that my family had lived in, there were illegal settlements and they had to flee, and my family fled and they had no citizenship. I still have the card. It's a card that just says that I'm from stateless Palestine. And with that card, you can't travel anywhere. You can't get into a lot of universities. It's basically like a stuck
road, there's no hope for the future. And the only reason that I have the privilege that I do and I have access to a lot of the things that I do is because I am Canadian and I went to Canada as a refugee and I adopted that citizenship. And it is so interesting that I've been privileged for so long that I didn't even know this, that I had that refugee card beforehand. And I'm just in this little bubble of living in the West and living in this Eurocentric kind of mind frame that I didn't understand what other people with that card had gone through, what I'd even gone through. So when it comes to refugees and helping these people bridge between the past and the future, I kind of identify with it more, I guess you could say. So let's talk about the narrative on refugees. Trump loves to call these people legal immigrants. Trump loves to paint this narrative that they're some form of criminals coming in to invade and take your jobs. First of all, Mr. Trump, first of all, you are talking on stolen land. The soil that your Trump towers are so ingrained in is stolen land. That isn't yours. You, sir, are an illegal immigrant. You are a criminal because you came to America. You stole this country from these people. You didn't specifically, your ancestors, rape, pillaged, did the most horrific crimes that anyone has ever done to these people. And you have the audacity to say that they can't come through your borders. Have several seats, Mr. Trump. This man enrages me in ways that are not possible. Any American or any Canadian, I apologize. I actually don't apologize. Any American or any Canadian who has the audacity to talk about illegal immigrants and illegal aliens, please remind yourselves that we are all on stolen land. We are all furthering colonialism. We are all colonialists right now. Me sitting in the seat in Waterloo, in Laurier, talking to you from this privileged area, I am promoting a colonialist agenda, and I am on stolen land. So we need to forget these narratives as to who is an illegal alien or not. These people, at the end of the day, come here for necessity. They come here for need. They come here for survival. And instead of meeting them with xenophobia and ignorance and hatred, let's welcome them like the indigenous people welcomed you before we raped and pillaged and still commit horrific things to indigenous people. We'll get into that into a later topic. Indigenous women are still being sterilized. Indigenous children are the most children to be in foster care. Indigenous men are the most men in the jail systems right now, specifically talking about Canada. So we can't forget where we're from. Let's just talk about resolution very quickly so we can wrap this all up. So in 1951, we have to understand that the international community has a responsibility to these refugees. In 1951, there was something invented called the Refugee Convention. And this was post-World War II, where the world was in shambles and there were so many refugees, primarily in Europe. So they said, we will do a Legal Protection Act that will make it a responsibility to share as what they called the burden of these people among us. And everyone has a right to welcome these refugees into their countries. Before, in 1951, this was primarily Europe. But in 1966, something called the 1967 Protocol expanded the scope of the convention as a problem that is all over the world. So this includes refugees. The list is 146 countries. So I can go on and on and on as to who has signed this list. And I'll tell you, it's the countries who have refused all these refugees that have signed this list. So the burden does not only mean taking in these countries. It's physical redistribution. It is financial assistance. And it is physical protection because, again, these people are coming from a war. These people have lost everything they've ever known. And they've traveled, they've crossed seas, they've crossed borders, they've faced persecution just to survive. So There's also an international customary law called the principle of non-refoulement, where you cannot forcibly return refugees who come to your border. They have the right of movement, the right of residence, and the right of employment. They also have the right of healthcare and education, but those are basic necessities. So countries who refuse refugees don't have that right either. And I understand, as a country that has a sudden influx of millions of refugees, that is hard to handle. But that is because we're leaving it to one country. There is a burden sharing clause that you've all signed, and everyone has to work together in the scope of the international community to work together. And there are so many false misconceptions about these refugees, and it just takes basic Google to find out if these are true or not. And I would just like to end this discussion by just reminding you guys that refugees are as human as we are. They are coming in from countries of natural disasters, natural calamities, of war, of persecution. They're dealing with a lot of mental, they're dealing a lot mentally. They have to cross a lot of language and cultural barriers. They just want to live like you and I. And concepts of citizenship, concepts of race, concepts of culture, these are all social constructs that we've made as human beings, and we have to understand that they're not biological. They're things that we've put in place, and we can't let these things that we've made up intervene in our humanity in dealing with people. So just please remember, I am Canadian and I have so much privilege, but that's not because I'm special or I have a DNA structure that makes me that way. It's just because of luck, literal luck. I could be in a refugee camp in Jordan, in Lebanon. I could be stuck in a number of countries, not able to do anything, not able to have access to education, have access to a radio show. I don't even know what, I don't know if I could. Blah, 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 brain fart. But all of what I'm able to do and say and talk is I'm understanding that it is a lot of privilege. So please remind yourself of that privilege. Please remind yourself that you are in the States, or you are in Canada, or you are in Europe, or you're in any country that has safety, and that is because of sheer luck and coincidence. And that these people, you have a responsibility to them. So I'm going to bring Adele on so we can both say bye. But thank you so much for listening. And
thank you so much for having me on here.
Adele's going to be here all the time, you guys.
Yeah, I'll always be here to give my opinions.
We're going to be skipping class all the time. Technically, the show was supposed to be at 1:30, but there were some technical mishaps that happened along the way. So we'll see you guys, same place, same time, 1:30 next week on Wednesday. And thank you so much for listening, and F the patriarchy, people.
Woo!
Goodbye.